Welcome to Loopcast, everyone. Here's my guest of honor today, Mervyn Dinan. He's an analyst, researcher, writer, influencer on HR, talent, and work tech trends. He is an international keynote, author of Exceptional Talent and Digital Talent that's going to come out in March 2022. Welcome, Mervyn.
Hello, Melisse. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. It's the sun is shining where I am in London, England, and that always makes me feel happy.
How is the new book coming?
The new book is fine. It is finished. It will be published on the 3rd of March next year. Wow. It is called Digital Talent. The final manuscript is with the publishers, Kogan Page. We're just kind of getting clarification and sign off the quotes and things. And I'm looking forward to kind of sharing it with the world.
I'm so excited for you. So how long was the difference between the last book and this one?
It will be just under 4 years in publication terms. It wasn't supposed to be as long. We started writing the second book at the end of 2018, beginning of 2019. But for a variety of personal reasons and then pandemic reasons, it got delayed. So which is just as well, because originally we wanted to release it at the end of 2019 or beginning of 2020. And it probably would have been out of date within a few weeks because of the pandemic. So it's probably just as well there was a delay.
I'm so happy for you. Really looking forward to that. So before I start with my soul bearing questions.
Yes, my soul is ready to be bared.
Okay, I won't stop then. I won't ask another weather question. So I'm
sure. No, ask the weather question. I'm British. That's all I talk about.
All right. So I'm really curious about habits, which the next question is all about. Give me three habits that you think best affect your performance at work and keeps you sane at the same time.
Number one, I would say knowing when to take a break. Mm-hmm. One thing that I remember, I worked for many years in sales environments when I was first in recruitment, and they can be quite pressurized. I worked for one company that was quite a high pressure sales environment. I didn't stay very long because it didn't bring the best out of me. But even in that kind of environment, I remember the owner of the business always had like a mantra, because it was very, very kind of telephone sales and stuff. And he said, a bad 5 minutes makes a bad hour. A bad hour makes a bad morning. A bad morning makes a bad day. A bad day makes a bad week. A bad week makes a bad month. A bad month makes a bad quarter. A bad quarter can make a bad year in a target-driven environment. So if you're having a bad 5 minutes, just get up, leave your desk, go for a walk, have a cigarette, have a coffee, whatever you want to do. Just change the scenery and then clear your head and come back. And I've often found, particularly with some of the stuff I've done in recent years with the writing and researching, that sometimes you can just disappear down a rabbit hole. You can't quite get the words out. You're not quite, you need that break. And rather than to push yourself harder and harder and harder, I will just get up, go outside. And it's easier now. I work from home. So, I mean, it's kind of, I can go for a walk around my look. I've got a park nearby I can walk around. But it's just, even when I was working in town, I would go out even for 10 minutes and get a coffee. But rather than just get a coffee and bring it back, I'd sit in and drink the coffee and not look at my phone. Because if I look at my phone, it's going to drive me back to emails and things. So I'd listen to music for 10 minutes rather than kind of check up on what I'm missing. But I think that need to identify when things are getting a bit on top of you, you're not giving your best, and it to take that little break, I think, is important. I would say the second habit, which will surprise some people listening who know me, because I'm tend to be quite a disorganized person. But one thing I learned from my early days when I studied to be an accountant is at the end of every day, I made a list of all the things I knew I had to do the next day. Mm-hmm. So letters, things I had to check up, chase up and stuff. And when I was in recruitment, it was calls I needed to make, maybe I hadn't had an answer on a CV or I hadn't had an answer on a client, a list of all the things. And then I'd make a new list every day. And I would kind of go through that list the following morning. Obviously, not all of it first thing, because sometimes you have to wait for other people to be around. But I would then, at the end of the day before I left, I would then make the next day's list. And obviously, there would be some things from the list the day before that didn't get done. And so they would be at the top, and then other things that had arisen from that day. And I had a kind of rule that if something was appearing on that list for 3 days or 4 days, depending on the time of year and how busy things were, it clearly doesn't need to be done. It's probably been resolved in another way. Rather than kind of that driving yourself mad that I still haven't done that thing. And it's, I think you need to understand the need to let go of some things and realize that you know, maybe I haven't done that because it doesn't need to be done. You know, life's gone on, business has happened, the world's turned, and I didn't really need to make that call. And I think the third habit, which actually probably brings us into a completely different question, but I've tried to maintain since very early days of my working life, is to avoid what I think are commonly known as mood hoovers. Those kind of people, a mood hoover is kind of person who just sucks the life out of you. Effectively, okay. I think quite a lot of life coaches use the expression. I think the description is people who suck the energy, life, and positivity out of a person and replace it with their own, I think, is the technical expression. And it is it's those people who are negative to you, who it just, when you're around them, you feel a bit flat, a bit meh, a bit kind of. And I know it's not always easy if you're in an office to kind of avoid them, but you need to find a way to kind of, if somebody is dumping their negativity on you, you need to find a way to, obviously we're speaking, people can't see, but I'm putting a hand up, like, you know, a policeman might stop the traffic by putting their hand up. You need to find a way to do that, to kind of change the subject. Or to look, I'm sorry to hear about all that, by the way. And look at that, the sun's shining, isn't it nice? Or what do you think about tomorrow night's game? Do you think England will win? Or something like that, which isn't rude. I don't mean, if somebody is sharing with you, and I want to be careful here because of well-being and because of I suppose, you know, some people might be sharing things with you because they need somebody to talk to. So you do, I suppose it is, it's understanding the difference between somebody who needs a bit of support and help and an ear, and somebody who just is just being negative because they want you to be. They're just sucking the life out of you. They're having a bad day. They want you to have a bad day. And it is, there is sometimes a fine line difference. And I think you have to trust yourself to know that you're not, maybe you're not putting your hand up to stop somebody who actually needs to talk to you. And needs to maybe talk and air those who are just automatically negative, or those who are braggers. They always want you to know how wonderful, you know, you get this in sales offices. Everybody wants to tell you about the call they've just made, which has just won them a big piece of business, and how brilliant they are, and kind of, yeah, they'll pick on all the people who are having a really bad week or month.
I love this. Talking about hoovers, when you're overwhelmed by hoovers or not, or let's say like you've lost focus temporarily, what do you do? Like you mentioned, you take a break, you go out to the park, you listen to some music. You also you mentioned a couple of other things, but they weren't really about the, you know, overwhelmed or lost focus part. So yes. When that happens, what do you do?
Personally speaking, I will try to do something different. So, I mean, I will try to, whether it's not going out for a walk, I will take a break. Right. So I will cut off, I will watch something. I don't mean I take the rest of the day off and watch a movie or something, but I will try to break, to get out of that cycle. Mm-hmm. That I suppose cycle of, I'm feeling stressed. I'm not actually on top of what I'm doing. I'm a bit worried about something. Things aren't going right. I can't really understand what it is I'm supposed to be doing. If it's work, then I will sometimes go back to the basics and start again. Mm-hmm. So it's almost a kind of, again, if I go back to my days working in recruitment agencies, you would often do that. You go and sit down with a colleague and say, it's just not happening for me today. And, you know, if it's the right colleague, they'd say, well, okay, let's start. Who have you got? Who are you working on? What are the open vacancies? What? And then actually help you realign by just talking to somebody for 10 minutes. You think, oh, why didn't I think of that? Why didn't I think of doing it that way? I think the break is important. I always think back to an example when I was much younger and I was doing my exams, my professional exams, and I was stuck on the very first paper of the four, and it was quite a difficult paper. Actually, the pass rate for that paper alone was only about 25 or 26%.
Ouch.
So it was really tough. And I was struggling. It's 3 hours you had, and I was coming up to 2 hours, and I had answered 1.5 questions. I didn't know what to do with the other half of that question. I still had two to answer, and I didn't know which ones. And I could feel the pressure. I mean, you're in an exam hall, so everybody around you is tense and pressured. But it felt, it's that kind of pressure you can always cut with a knife, the tension. And I thought, I've just got to get out of here. So I did, for the first time in my life ever in an exam, I put my hand up and said I needed to go to the toilet. And then you, I don't know how other countries do it and other, but somebody has to escort you to make sure you're not then going to pull a load of notes out of your pocket while you go to the toilet. So that happened. I didn't know why. I just thought, I've got to get out of this room. And it wasn't, I mean, you know, visiting the toilet, it wasn't very long. It was probably only about 30, 40 seconds from leaving my desk to being back at my desk. But it kind of, I completely, everything reshaped. I just, that 40 seconds of going out and coming back in again, and just not, the pressure didn't feel the same. The pressure that was weighing down was suddenly broken by just going out for 40 seconds. And when I thought, hold on a minute, let's forget the question I'm stuck on. Let's do something new, because otherwise I'm just going to go down this rabbit hole of this question I'm stuck with. And let's do something new. And I looked at, you know, you have a choice. You don't answer all the questions. And I looked at the question I decided I wasn't going to answer and thought, oh, actually, why aren't I answering that one? I can do that one. And I started work and I thought, ah, oh, this is, I'm so glad I've chosen this question now. And that gave me the confidence to go back and eventually at the end finish the question I was stuck on. I did the four. I actually was one of the 26% who passed it. But it's just that it sometimes do something different, and sometimes you just need a break, and it doesn't have to be for like a morning, a day. So I mean, for some it needs to be. But just like, you know, I talk about walking around the park for half an hour or something to just get some fresh air. But sometimes it's just doing something that just stops the pressure. And even if it's for 40 seconds or so, you'll be surprised how much that one thing, providing you don't think about it during that 40 seconds, you come back in and you can have a fresh perspective.
That brings me to, was it Albert Einstein, I think, and how he said, you know, you can't expect to have different outcomes doing the same thing over and over.
Yes.
Yeah, I love that. Okay. Thank you for sharing that with me. I love that.
I was younger at the time and I hadn't really considered it. I've thought back about it a few times, you know, when we talk in examples of pressure, I say, well, I just once in an exam, I just went to the, I didn't even need to go to the toilet, yes. But I just needed to get out of that room.
Yeah,
I didn't know
different.
If it was going to be for 20 seconds or a minute, or I just needed to get out of there because I felt I was being sucked down by the pressure and the kind of panic because I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to finish the question. I didn't know which question to do next. And I could see time ebbing away.
I'll take you to a hypothetical situation now, out of the toilet. Ready?
Okay. Sorry.
So I'm taking you to a place, you know, a very busy street. And I just bought a gigantic billboard for you. And you get to pick what gets to be said on that billboard. What's it going to be?
I suppose over the years, there would have been, you could have asked me this question many different times over the years. I've probably had something different to say, usually about believing in yourself and things like that. I am going to say something. I'm going to a serious point I'm going to make, because obviously the last 18 months, 20 months have been quite tough for a lot of people. And a lot of people have found a very different rhythm to their life, whether it's because they're working from home, whether it's because they're spending a lot more time with a partner, whether because, you know, in the UK, we've had, like most places, a series of lockdowns and things. You can't see other people, you can't socialize. And unfortunately, in the last 4, 5, or 6 months, a couple of people that meant a lot to me for different reasons have passed away. It's been one of those times when, I think people have felt it more. One of the people who passed away was a guy who's quite well known in the UK HR community. He was an HR director. He was very active in the Twitter community, the blogging community, also the music community, a guy called Matt Davis. So people from the UK listening will probably know who I mean. And he did an interview with one of the HR magazines about 3-4 years ago. And they asked what his motto in life was. So I'm putting this on a billboard in memory of Matt. He said, "You only get one go at life. Make sure the go you have is an amazing one." And it's kind of, you know, it has extra poignancy because of what's happened to him over the last few months. But I just think that ultimately it is, we get one go at life. And, you know, life can be fragile. And just be yourself, do what you want to do. Don't feel pressured. I know sometimes there's not a lot we can do with pressure, but just try to do what you want to do all the time. Ignore the mood hoovers, ignore sometimes just focus on what life means to you and have an amazing go at just living life and enjoying life and people and stuff.
What's adding that goal to your life at the moment? Like, where are you seeing the most, comfort, out of comfort zone experience happening right now for you?
The most out of comfort zone experience. I try to live within my comfort zone, of course. I suppose I'm lucky enough in some respects to say that I don't have, I'm not really out of comfort zone at the moment. I think that, again, the last couple of years have been tough in many ways for many people. And I think that what I've identified, because, the going out and about, socializing, the rituals that make a part of my life, I'm a season ticket holder at a football club in London. I'm used to going every week during the season to watch them. I'm used to going out at least once or two nights a week, socializing with friends, visiting family. There's things I'm used to doing all the time that suddenly stopped. And I think that it's a chance to look back and kind of just not prioritize so much, but just think, what do I enjoy doing? What are the little things? Not so much the big experience.
Right.
So I say going to a football match. It's the journey, the people I sit with. It's all the little things about it that I missed, because all the matches were live on TV, so you could watch them all. There were no crowds there, obviously. But it's all the other things, which is mainly the people, I suppose, and how do I take a route where I do more walking than on the tube? Do I go to a different station? Just almost looking to mix things up a bit, so you're not always stuck in routines. And I think because it's been thrust upon us over the last 18 months, we've got into a routine. It's a different routine. It's, people working from home. I will throw my hands up and say, I do understand for those shouting at this recording saying, it's only a small proportion of people who are able to work at home. I know that most jobs that we rely on for our lives can't be done from people sitting at home.
Exactly.
But in general, I think that it's the interaction, the socializing, the things we take for granted, and just looking at, almost reprioritizing the people we mix with, what we do with them, how we do it with them. And why do we go to the same restaurant every time? Why do I always get my coffee from Starbucks and not somewhere? Yeah, that kind of, why don't I get it from a local coffee shop? You know, all those kind of things. I think it's whilst there's a lot of misery and ill health, and I'm not trying to lighten it, I think for the what we're talking about, I think for me, it's been an opportunity to maybe realign some of the things I do and how I do them and what I get pleasure from doing.
Well, okay. It sounds like you've got a lot of things sorted out. Very much parallel to that, I have a question for you. What are some bad recommendations you hear in your profession or area of expertise, and what would you tell people instead?
Bad. Well, it's full of bad. Funny, my father always used to say to me about, you know, there's no substitute for hard work. And right. I'd like to think, unfortunately, my father's no longer with us, but I mean, I'd like to think that, you know, if he's looking down, he might look back and say, oh, well, my son bucked that trend, didn't he? I think that in the workplace, we are or have been historically very focused on, you know, people, you know, energy, enthusiasm, focus, drive, motivation. And it's kind of like, if you're going to come in here and work, you know, you've got to be like this. And I think we have so much more understanding now of general like experience, you know, work experience, employee experience, all the different experiences that you get working. I think that it's understanding that some people do things in different ways, and it's allowing people, giving people room to I'm a big believer in the micro experiences, which I know companies like OC Tanner Work Human write about, and the Peak and Valley experiences, two American doctors, Chip and Dan Heath, I think, about the little experiences we get at work. It's not the big experience. It's the little tiny things that make up the day-to-day rituals. You know, it can be the coffee machine not working when you get there. They're just tiny things. But it's understanding that, you know, the experience we have working and the way we enjoy ourselves is not some overarching, framework that the company sets. Mm-hmm. It's the result of all those many, many hundreds of micro experiences we get. Like the laptop doesn't start when we open it, and kind of might think, well, that's nothing. You know, it was working a couple of minutes later. But it's that, and it's understanding, and that's what Chip and Dan Heath, I think, wrote about, is that the peak and the valley experiences. The valley experiences are the bad experiences.
Oh, okay.
And the negative feeling is sharper, it's deeper, mm-hmm. but it doesn't last as long. The peak experiences, the good little experiences we have, aren't as sharp as the bad experiences, but they last longer. And so the advice that I always give if I'm speaking from the stage or writing or to companies is it's understand the positive peak experiences and maximize them. Most people who work in HR, L&D, recruitment, spend our time trying to iron out the bad experiences. That's what we believe, you know, just get rid of the bad experience. Mm-hmm. Where actually, sometimes we just have to accept that this will happen. So-and-so happens. I won't use the word, but you know, bad things happen. And sometimes we just have to accept that. And just if we maximize the good times, then the good experiences, the good things that happen, then overall, it's a positive experience. I don't know if that's helped answer that question, but I think that we do, as individuals, spend a lot of time focusing on what's gone wrong. And we don't spend enough time focusing on what's gone right for us individually. And how, you know, why it went right, and maybe what we can learn from that the next time something is going wrong.
I'm so excited about this answer because so at Loop Summit we hosted Lori Santos last year, and she always talks about how human brains tend to focus on the negative. And the book of Martin Seligman, Flourish, you also brought that to my mind, because Seligman in his book Flourish, he talks about like how he started out his profession as a psychologist back in the 1970s, And he started to look at it. And so like, oh my God, we're like only focusing on the negative side of psychology. Like we're putting millions of dollars of research money into like fixing depression, anxiety. But like he says, and that's, he says that in his book, like, I've seen that like when you treat depression and anxiety, what you get is a neutral person. Like you need to do something else to help a person thrive. You know, to be able to do that, you need to have some other initiative going on or some other, you need to do a different intervention at that person, he says. And yeah, like that totally brought up, like when you were talking about the valley and the peak, like that conversation immediately brought up that to my mind. And when you're talking about peak situations, peak experiences, like you gave a couple of examples on the valley ones with the computer not working. What are some of the peak ones?
Well, the computer always works. I mean, so much of our working lives are dictated by technology now. I'm fond of giving the example that from the leisure industry. If you look at something like a flight attendant on an aircraft, which is a physical job, you can't do it virtually, but that job is now digital. Everything that used to happen, and I know this because I'm married to one, everything that used to happen, anything from their flying rosters to the reports to everything was all physical. They went into an office, they picked up their papers, they this, that, and the other, they had training manuals. Everything is now controlled through an iPad. And one of the things we do in organizations, I think this is quite important to the well-being conversation, is we just assume that people will like this because, well, it's technology, baby. Everyone's on Facebook, so they're going to love this. But not everybody wants their job to be digitized, particularly if they haven't asked for it to be digitized. So I think it's that, and this is one of the tenets of the, it sounds like I'm plugging the second book. I don't mean to, but you know, a digital transformation is an organizational change. You are changing the way somebody does their job. And it might be, this is brilliant, why have I spent all those years doing it that way when two buttons and it's the algorithm does it or something. But there will be a lot of things that people like the way they did, particularly when it's personal to them. And it can be something as simple as reclaiming expenses or getting their pay slip or something. If it all becomes a bit of a hassle and a bit of a chore, because they've got to do it a different way and the tech doesn't work and it's kind of, oh, you know, you've got to be on Wi-Fi to upload that, to airdrop that to your claim. And it makes it a negative, it makes it a valley experience. What was a peak experience, it makes it a valley experience. So I think with technology, we have to be very careful that we're not making the overall employee experience a negative thing. Yeah, it comes out in a lot of the surveys I've seen that people say that you know, if the technology they use at work, they don't like, they don't get on, they feel it hinders them, that they're more likely to leave and join another organization. I don't know if that answers your question, but it's one of my pet bugbears. Is that I think that we need to understand the micro experiences, as we said, but I think it's just understanding that not everybody, you know, it's not a one size fits all. We're all humans and we're all different, and we will all have individual preferences. And I think it's very difficult to understand that. I think you know, the great leaders, the great managers kind of understand that, but I think that you know, a lot of people work in environments where maybe that isn't understood. And it's like, you know, there's no room for individuals here. You know, that might be your quirk, but we don't have those quirks here. And that's, I think that's a shame. And I think that ultimately also impacts the person negatively. I don't know if that's answered your question or.
It does perfectly. And like, it brought up another question to my mind. So you're seeing so many organizations during the year because of your title, your job as a consultant. And is there like a super surprising, maybe peak moment related to well-being, to use your vocabulary?
Lots of people do lots of good things. I think that, I mean, for me, I suppose that the most important two or three things, and that's probably from the research I've been doing writing the book, which has been most of the last couple of months, is when people join us. So I'm a big believer in what they call onboarding, obviously, but I mean in the fact that onboarding happens early. If we're hiring for a role and we've maybe done 10 first interviews and we're bringing four people back, one of those four is going to probably be the next employee. There is absolutely no reason why the onboarding can't start at that stage. And the other three who might not get offered the job are certainly have passed, have shown themselves to have something about them that they could be somebody that we hire in the future. So there is no harm in beginning the onboarding process early, even if we start that with people who don't ultimately join at that time. I saw some research about 3 or 4 years ago. It was only a small piece of research done with half a dozen SMEs. But what it showed is that they were looking at they were taking a different approach to trying to understand the candidate experience. And they were looking at the key points from hearing about a vacancy to having been working for an organization for 3 months. And at each stage, they were asking people how engaged they felt, different feelings about that, how they felt about the organization that they were applying to and hoping to join. And the th things that stood out for me is that the two points at which people felt least engaged were the two points where they said the information flow was at its weakest. And they were between the first and second interview and after they had accepted an offer.
Oh,
So
interesting.
we've interviewed somebody, we've kind of invited them back. So yes, you're a possible. And then we're not sending them what they want to know. And then we've made them an offer, they've accepted it, probably resigned, and then they hear nothing. Maybe a few days before they start, they might get an email saying, here's your login or something, or be there at 9 o'clock to meet your manager. Or, it's not the modern digital world is seamless. It happens all the time. While we're sleeping at night, everything's happening on our phones. It's kind of, Twitter doesn't stop because we've gone to bed. Facebook doesn't stop. The tech we use at work doesn't stop because we're sleeping. And so it's and the whole process of hiring, attracting, hiring, developing, retaining people in organizations itself never sleeps. It's an ongoing thing. It's not, okay, well, we've chosen the four people for second interview. We'll put that to one side because we can't do those interviews for a couple of weeks. And it's like, what a missed opportunity.
And have you seen like a peak moment created there by a company like that we can take as a case study maybe?
Lord, I didn't know you were going to ask me that. I would have one top of mind. I think that the going above and beyond in terms of access you give them, information, I mean, in terms of the candidate experience, so if we're talking about that phase, I think the absolute peak experience you give somebody is actionable feedback. All the research, and I've done a recent project on candidate experience, and it's all the candidate application research shows that what candidates want is they want to know what's going on. They want to be kept in the loop. They want to be they are loop. They want to know what's going on. They want to know where they stand. That the old days of if you haven't heard back, we need applications by this date. If you don't hear back within 7 days, we're not interested. No, that's not Netflix. Don't say, okay, we know you want a subscription. If we don't. If you don't get anything from us in the next 7 days, assume we don't want you as a subscriber. It doesn't happen like that in the modern digital world doesn't work like that. And the world of work has to itself change. So I think that, what can organizations do? Not keep people hanging around, not leave people, and this is whether they're applying to join you, whether this is they're working for you, whether they're looking to leave you, not keep them in the dark about what's happening. Make sure they always know in their personal lives what's happening with everything. Mm-hmm. You know, if they buy something on Amazon, they're going to get at least half a dozen updates telling them when it's arriving. It's not, well, thanks for the order. It'll pitch up when we're ready. And so we then go into the workplace and it's, well, I had an interview a week ago. I've not heard. Am I still, you know, I've emailed the recruiter twice and it's not just ignored. And I think what we can do in organizations is communicate. Mm-hmm. And this is even if people are working for us, you know, there's plenty of times, you know, if you're working for an organization and you've asked for, it could be anything from time off, you've put in for something or you want to work on a project or, yeah, and you don't really hear much back. And this comes out in talent mobility, which is obviously quite a hot topic this year, people, internal mobility, moving around an organization, that a lot of the research I was involved in found that when organizations are hiring, quite often the people who work there don't know what the vacancies are because they don't want, a lot of managers don't want their people applying for other jobs internally. So there's no real visibility that actually that team over there are hiring for someone like you, but your team doesn't want you to know that. So it's kind of, I think everything needs to be open and visible. It's digital now, it's available, it's there. And I think it's just treating people so that they are always aware of what's happening. They're always, I think that's almost respect in the modern workplace. People know what's happening. People know where they stand. And particularly during processes like joining a company, when you're going through kind of development, learning and development, or you know what's happened. Right. And there are a couple of stats. I know I'm going off tangent slightly, but there's a stat in the US that gets used a lot. That something like almost 2/3 of people say it's easier to find a new job in another company than it is to move within the one they're in. And you know, it's kind of that we were involved in research, and it was kind of, it was almost a third admitted that people left their organization to take up a job that they could have done had they stayed and known there was a job there. And so I think, you know, to I suppose bring it back to kind of well-being in the world of work, mm-hmm. nothing supports well-being better than letting your people know that they have the chance to learn, develop, and grow with you as an organization, and you're willing to invest that in them. And that's the reason they join. I mean, wherever the research comes from, we know the number one thing that they're looking for when they join a company is the chance to learn new skills, to grow, to develop. And that's why they choose one company over another, because they think they've got better access to learning, more opportunity to develop. And it's kind of, if we take that away from them, then it's kind of, you know, it's a negative experience. We're almost disrespecting them. And it's kind of, you know, they don't know where they stand. It's, you know, I want to do more of this and I don't know. I've spoken to my manager. He said, leave it with him and then or her. And that was like months ago. And you know, there's this job advertised. Should I leave? And these kind of things are happening every day, constantly around the world. And so it does, you know, bring it all back. Everything comes back to organizational culture. But there's many different cultures within an organization. And it's kind of a culture of mobility. I think it's quite a hot topic at the moment. And it's just people knowing, well, actually, I'm in an organization that will actually support me, that will help me, enable me to work better and to improve. And that creates a very different bond. That gives people some kind of peace of mind. It gives people some, you know, comfort in the knowledge of that. And I think that it's also, it's a positive experience. And it's a positive experience they're going to want to share.
I love the CX example that you gave. Like you're saying, you just gave customer experience example from Amazon, right? Like how you can track for your packages. And you're basically saying is like, you know, look at the current CX practices and your EX, like employee experience. And what you're also saying and what I'm hearing from your words is that like well-being is not just a one-off thing or a project. Like well-being is actually throughout the entire employee experience, actually, like from learning to onboarding, like from development to like performance. Like it should be on the basis of all, each discussion. Maybe with a small, maybe salt and pepper of transparency on top, which I love. Yes. Before we conclude, I want to ask you something, one of my very soul-bearing questions, and then I want to conclude it at that. which is, what's an unusual thing that Mervyn loves?
Oh, what's an unusual thing I love? my mind always goes to music. And I think as somebody from London, England, who's not a spring chicken anymore, I would say that one of the absurd artists who I love, and I don't know anybody else who loves him, is Kanye West. And I think he possibly qualifies as absurd. And that's what I love about it, because I think back to years when I was a kid and people like David Bowie would come out with really outrageous things. And I would have to be defending to my parents when I wasn't old enough to really understand that, no, he doesn't really mean it. And it's kind of, he's good anyway. And you know, it's Kanye West. I just enjoy watching it. I mean, I love his albums, and I always think you never know what's going to come next.
Then here's for Kanye West, hands up.
Yes. Well, for Ye, I think he's actually officially changed his name to Ye now.
Oh my God, did he? Okay, I need to catch up on my pop culture. All right, everybody. This was Mervyn Dinan for Loopcast. Thank you so much, Mervyn, for being with us.
It's been my pleasure, Melise. Thank you for hosting me.